What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd, joined today by special guest co-host Randeep Janda. What's going on, man?
What's going on, Jamie?
Not too much.
I enjoyed the long weekend. It was kind of low key. Hope everybody out there enjoyed it as well.
Mine was way too busy, but that's all right. I'm getting back to relaxing work now.
You got kids, right? So they're doing their own thing. They're living their life. You're living yours.
Absolutely. We're broadcasting live from the Kintech studio, Kintech Footwear and Orthotics, working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. And I should mention, of course, as well, Randeep Janda on Sportsnet 650 is a presentation of Bells and Whistles, your new favorite place to catch all the action, hockey, football, soccer, and more on Fraser, right in the Fraser Hood on socials at Bells and Whistles YVR. And a lot to get into today, Randeep. Of course, the second round of the playoffs wrapping up over the weekend. Conference finals get going tonight in the East with Carolina and Florida. The Final Four is set. Another spectacular Leafs flame out in the postseason that we can dive into. And we'll talk to Shayna Goldman at 12:30, and Landon Ferraro will join us at 1. But we're going to start a little closer to home here. And I've noticed over the last couple of years, and this has probably been going on longer than that as well, the Canucks and Canucks fans, Canucks media, we don't do clean breakups. There's no like, okay, clean, it's over, bye, you go your way, we'll go ours, and then it's done, right? Like, think about Bo Horvat with the I'll tell you that for free, reignites this whole controversy and discussion. Obviously, the JT Miller trade, that's still hotly contested, hotly debated. And the latest now is Rick Tocchet leaving for Philadelphia. Adam Foote, the new head coach of the Vancouver Canucks, and it's not a clean break. And Rick Tocchet was on our pals Donnie and Dolly earlier today on Check TV. You can see the whole interview on their YouTube channel. It sounded like, as much as I think a lot of Canucks fans wanted to hear more from Rick Tocchet about why he left, why he decided to leave the Canucks and choose to go coach the Philadelphia Flyers instead, it sounded like Rick Tocchet had a lot that he wanted to say. As a parting shot makes it sound a little more confrontational than it was, but just some final statements he wanted to make about his time here as well.
Maybe clear the air is the way that you could look at it, because I think there's one thing that we know about Rick Tocchet after listening to that interview, and we'll probably share a little bit of it as well. But Rick Tocchet listens and he sees what's being said about him.
Yep.
And he understands that remember, it's not a shock. He works in media. And as a media member, one of the things you have to do is consume media. You have to see what's going on around the market.
Yep.
You have to go around league-wide and see and hear what's being said. I think there were a couple of things that Rick Tocchet heard about his style of coaching, maybe his strategy employed. And it felt like that interview today, he wanted to clear the air and say, sometimes it's the style. It was pretty successful. And look, you know, that dump and chase style that people throw his way, that label, it's working pretty well for a couple of teams, especially the Florida Panthers. So I felt like this was of course, thank you, Vancouver. I'm going to go my separate way now, and I wanted to talk to you directly. But at the same time, for people that maybe were throwing a little bit of mud at his style, I want to kind of clear the air on that front, too.
At the same time, it was, listen, I see what you guys are saying on social media. I see what you guys are saying out there.
We're both hip-hop guys. There was a little bit of I ain't mad at you, but also a little bit of hit 'em up in it. A little bit of both.
Just letting you know, I'm well aware. And, of course, he hit some of the, the obvious questions, but didn't go into a ton of detail about why he left. Basically said, fresh start, wanted to go back east. You know, sometimes you come to a fork in the road and you make the decision that you think is right for you at the moment. Had generally nothing but positive things to say about his experience here in Vancouver. But the most interesting part of it for me, and I think the thing that's most relevant for the Canucks going forward, because, again, you know, Rick Tocchet doesn't coach here. He's not a part of the organization. So his views on his experience, or they might be interesting, but they're not really necessarily relevant for the Canucks going forward. But I did think there was one answer, and, you know, it's not going to shock you, Randy, to hear that it involved Elias Pettersson. Of course, one of the focal points during Rick Tocchet's tenure as the Canucks head coach was his relationship with Elias Pettersson, Elias Pettersson's performance and all that. And I thought he gave a very, very interesting answer when asked about that on Donnie and Dolly. Here's what Rick Tocchet had to say about Elias Pettersson.
I'm from the bottom of my heart, he's going to have a bounce back year. You know, even when I was deciding to come back or not, we spent some time. I mean, he was in the gym. We had some long talks. You know, listen, he's a great kid. He's got to get his confidence for himself, but also his teammates. He's got to get the teammates to have confidence in him again. And I made a comment like a month or two ago about reprogramming, and people freaked out in the city. What I mean by reprogramming, like, Petey likes to slow the game down a little bit. In today's game, it's a lot evolved. If you guys are watching the playoffs, there's not a lot of room.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a lot of tic-tac-toe and take it back. It's straight on hockey, and it's beating pressure. And Petey likes to come back and play kind of that slower game, and I think it affected him. Like, you know, I know that, you know, he wished he came in better shape last year, and I think he'll be more prepared. But you got to play that style. And so when I'm talking about reprogramming, I was talking more of coming back, getting the puck and taking off, or when, you know, in the power play, when he gets the puck on the side there, when you beat pressure, that's the time you attack, you know, and you learn from the McDavids and you learn from all these top level players at Crosby's, where when they beat pressure, I mean, they're attacking. So I think he just got, that's what I meant, reprogram. It just kind of, he's just going to invent his game a little bit differently. I know he had 100 points a few years ago, and everybody wants to, well, you know, how do you change a 100 point guy? Well, you got to evolve. I don't care who you are. And I think that's what I meant. But the kid is, the kid's going to have a good year this year. I really believe it. Footy's going to really help him, I think, with the relationship, that Footy's really good with relationships. And I think Petey's, you know, he's had enough. You know, he's taken it. And listen, we all get kicked in the ass, and we all take the heat. We get praised too, right? When he was playing well, he got praised. When you're not playing well, you're going to get it. Same thing with me. I won the Jack Adams. I got praised last year. Didn't go our way, and you get some criticism. So you got to deal with it. That's the business we're in.
That's Rick Tocchet on Elias Pettersson, and there's a lot in there. And as we were saying, he's well aware of the conversation in this market. You know, again, he brings up, and I was on with Brof when he said the, you know, trying to reprogram Petey's brain a little bit, right? And he was obviously well aware of the reaction that got and some of the controversy that quote generated, bringing it up again. And, oh, people ask, you know, how can you reprogram a 100-point player? But a couple of things really stand out to me from that. One was Rick Tocchet saying, not only does Petey need to get his confidence back, which I think is obvious. We can all agree, whatever, however you want to divide the reasons for Pettersson struggling, mostly physical, mostly mental, I think we all understand that his confidence is low and he needs to get that confidence back. But the other thing I found interesting, he goes on to say, not just that Pettersson needs to get his own confidence back, he's got to get confidence from his teammates again. He needs to earn that confidence back from his teammates in that room. And that might, if you stop and think about it, sound obvious. Because, of course, your teammates' confidence in you is going to be damaged when you had as underwhelming a season as Pettersson just finished here. But that's a really big deal. And I think that is such an interesting way to think about it. It's not just what can Pettersson do individually in his training and his preparation and all of that. How is he feeling? How does the rest of the team look at Elias Pettersson and what he's gone through? What level of confidence do they have in him being able to, again, become a 100-point two-way player down the middle? And when we're talking about what other members of the Vancouver Canucks think about Elias Pettersson, you know, number one on that list is Quinn Hughes. What does Quinn Hughes think about it? How much confidence does he have in Pettersson's game? I thought it was very interesting that Rick Tocchet was alluding to that being a major issue going forward as well.
And that player is really important in this conversation, obviously being the captain, but in any internal team dynamic, now without JT Miller, who's the Batman, who's the Robin, it doesn't matter which name goes where, but your top two players are Elias Pettersson, Quinn Hughes. As of right now, probably say Quinn is Batman, and Elias, if he can up his game, would be Robin a little bit, right? You need that 1-2 punch. But you need your star player, your fellow star player, to have confidence in you. You need to allow them to feel like, hey, I got some support. And I'll give you Edmonton as an example. Yeah. I think that is probably the best example in the NHL where everything could be going sideways with the team. But as long as you have your top two stars locked in, on any given night, you have an opportunity to win a game. And that's what Edmonton has been able to, I wouldn't say perfect because they haven't won the Stanley Cup, but they came pretty close last year, and they might again this year. for Vancouver and the top two stars, you have to have that sort of chemistry. You have to have that confidence in each other. So with Quinn Hughes, absolutely. But even beyond that, other players on that team see Elias Pettersson as a leader.
Yeah. Or at least they should. That should be the role he's playing. Whether they or not should. They do is, I think, an open question.
I think the trajectory is there, and the fan base expects that, too. When you're paid a certain amount, you have to have an element of leadership, or maybe not leader, but they feed off of you. They feed off your energy. And, Jamie, I was at practice almost every single day last year, and there were certain moments where the drill would die with Elias Pettersson because the puck would bobble off his stick on a power play drill, and then they'd reset again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that that happens, you know, that happens with a lot of players. But it's the body language and the way that you react in those situations that your teammates feed off you. So you got to execute. You got to come in ready. You have to have a certain level of, call it professionalism, call it confidence, whatever it may be. But the rest of that team is going to feed off you, whether you feel like you want to be a leader or not. And Elias has said he wants to be a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's so imperative that he actually hit that level, because you're right, Quinn Hughes needs a running mate. He needs somebody that can hit those high levels with him now that JT Miller's gone. But also, you got to inspire the rest of the team. And that's a very important role for a star player like Elias Pettersson.
And you know, the phrase that people always used about JT Miller, right? He's the guy who drags the team into the fight. And I think we all know, obviously, Elias Pettersson and JT Miller, very different personalities, very different styles, but there are different ways to lead. Elias Pettersson, probably never going to be the vocal guy standing up and giving the rah-rah speech in the room. But can you lead with your preparation, with your attention to detail, with your practice habits? There's not going to be just one leader on the team, right? Quinn Hughes, okay, he's an amazing leader, but you need more. You need other people to be a part of that, and it has to start with Elias Pettersson. And we talk so much about who are the Canucks going to bring in to help convince Quinn Hughes to stay, right? Can they sign Sam Bennett? Are they going to be in on Mitch Marner now?
Nick Ehlers.
All of this,
yeah.
Nick Ehlers. The number one thing that could help convince Quinn Hughes to stay with the Canucks is Elias Pettersson being a beast. Elias Pettersson getting back to being an elite player. Like, that is far and away the easiest route. Whether you think it's likely or not is another question, but the most direct route to convincing Quinn Hughes to stay. And again, it's not just about Elias Pettersson hitting a certain number of points or anything like that. But as Rick Tocchet said, it's about getting that confidence from the other guys in the room that they look at Pettersson and see, this is a guy we can win with. We can win with him being our highest paid player and our number one center.
There also comes to, I think there's a part of that clip where Rick Tocchet mentioned that Petey likes to slow down the game. He likes to reset. Look at the teams that are in the playoffs right now. Connor McDavid resets, but he's
the fastest player in the game, so much faster
than everybody else. It doesn't matter, right? Look at Carolina. They're a north-south team.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Panthers play, they're dump and chase, but they also carry the puck through too. They have a lot of puck support where they're going to give you an option of, hey, if you're gonna try to play us a certain way, we'll chip it past you.
Yep.
But we can skate the puck north-south as well. So this comes down to mentality. Elias Pettersson has been told that that's the way he needs to play, but in that moment, you revert to what you know, or do you slow it down? So I think, you know, it's between the ears. Can this player get back to the level of thinking that he is great?
Yes.
It's mentality. It's not, I think a lot of the issues, and sure, the preseason training and not being in the best shape, you know, you have to do that. That is the bare minimum in today's NHL. But Jamie, on top of that, the big dogs in this league know they're good.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even a guy like Sasha Barkov, who is very understated, if Elias Pettersson wants to look at a player who's not a rah-rah guy, that's the gold standard. But you have to make sure that you have that mentality of, I'm a killer. When I'm on the ice, there's nobody better than me. And he's been lacking that the last 2 years.
Well, and I think maybe the most hopeful thing that I heard from Rick Tocchet in that answer on Elias Pettersson was just a little line, but he said he's had enough. Isn't that what you hope, right? That Elias Pettersson looks at everything that's happened over the last 15 months or however long and says, man, that sucked and I'm done with that. That's over, and I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that doesn't happen again, to make sure that's over. And for Rick Tocchet to say, yeah, I think he's had enough, that is maybe the most hopeful thing I've heard anyone say, because that's the exact mentality you want. You want him to have that chip on his shoulder where he's fed up with us talking about it and everyone else talking about it, and he comes in to shut us up and prove him wrong. And I hope that's what Rick Tocchet is suggesting we'll see from Elias Pettersson.
And, you know, that's followed up basically the conversation that Rutherford and Alvin had at their end of season presser, saying he's working out. You know, all of this stuff is positive to say, you know, you've gotten to a point where you're saying, I've had enough. But this market, this media, and maybe even some players in the locker room are not going to believe it until they see it. Like, you have to show up the correct way. You have to flip that switch. And I know changing the way you think, maybe, and changing the mentality that you have on the ice, it's not that he hasn't had it. He's had it before. It's just like, how do you get back there? And that's going to be, I think, this market is going to believe it when they see it, just because the last 2 years have been rough.
Yeah. By the way, Johnny from Langley texts in kind of insane comments out of Tocchet, who is not our coach, so in depth. Shouldn't he be focused on Philly? I had that thought too. It's like, you don't normally hear this amount of detail from a guy who not just is like the ex-coach. That's one thing, right?
Usually they like tie it down and say, I'm not saying anything.
Yeah. Like, Bruce Boudreau's out of coaching. So he'll go into some detail now, right?
Will he ever?
Like, Tocchet's a coach. He's coaching another team, and he's talking about another team's players. And I was kind of thinking, you know, Rutherford, when there was all the noise around talking to Philly after they fired Torts, and he made sure to get out there and be like, hey, guys, shut up. Now, it didn't amount to anything because eventually he goes to Philly.
Yeah.
But if I was Jim Rutherford, I'd be like, hey, talk, we're boys, but like, hey, come on. You're in Philly now. Go worry about Travis Konecny and Matvei Michkov.
Exactly. You know, you gotta make an NHL everyday player out of you gotta rediscover whatever.
You gotta reprogram Matvei Michkov now.
Probably, right?
After a breakup, you've never went back and been like, listen, it's been 4 days, but I have
here's
some
what you need to work on.
No, here's the thing, folks. Going through any breakup, drunk texts are not the way to go. Going full on Marvin.
Clean break. Make a clean break.
Marvin's room, Drake, is not the way to go, all right?
And I say make a clean break, but we are 100% going to try to get Rick Tocchet on this show. So we'll make a clean break after that.
Rick Tocchet just sends the, hey, baby girl, I'm just in the new practice facility, and got me thinking maybe we should have practiced
relationship. Man. All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Looking back at the weekend, number one story, of course, and we'll look forward. We'll do our conference final previews and talk about the Final Four teams and all that. But we got to start with the Leafs flaming out again in the playoffs in spectacular fashion, losing game 7, 6-1 at home against Florida. And they were just absolutely dominated, especially in the second period on in that game. It was ugly. Fans are throwing jerseys on the ice during play. There's a big puddle of beer on the ice at the end of that game. They're booing Mitch Marner. Just gnarly stuff. And as angry as everyone in Toronto is at the Leafs, it's kind of funny because I don't know that I've ever seen a victorious team be more sympathetic to the team they just beat. The Panthers are like all in on, oh, those poor Leafs. You guys are just so hard on them. I mean, Brad Marchand, Paul Maurice, Matthew Tkachuk, all coming out and basically saying, well, what do you want? What do you want from the Leafs? You guys talk about them so much, it'd be impossible for them to win. And, you know, I do think part of this we got to recognize, like, I think part of this is just twisting the knife from the Panthers, especially from Tkachuk and Marchand.
With those two players,
yeah,
they are masters of the dark arts.
Like, when Brad Marchand comes out and is like, it's not a high pressure game. I've played for the Stanley Cup. That's not high pressure.
You call this pressure?
Like, that is twisting the knife from the ultimate troll in the NHL. Matthew Tkachuk, also one of the biggest trolls in the NHL. We don't have to take their words at face value. Paul Maurice, a little bit different. I'm sure there's some more earnestness there in his comments. But now it's reignited this debate about how much is the pressure in Canadian markets preventing teams like the Leafs or the Canucks from being successful, from winning the cup. And of course, we all know about the Stanley Cup drought in Canada. And I think there's a lot of different ways to go with this, and maybe we'll return to it later in the show as well. Obviously, pressure can be difficult to deal with, and there's more of it in a big Canadian market. So I understand that. Pressure is a real thing. It impacts athletes. It impacts how they perform. But I also think it gets blown out of proportion, just the degree to which the media attention affects things for players in these markets. You know, Tkachuk, I think, called it a circus. Like, oh, they got to deal with the circus every day. But at least, you know, I can't speak to what it's like to be around the Maple Leafs on a day-to-day basis. But you're around the Canucks on a day-to-day basis. Yep. The actual media obligations they have, though, the individual players have, I don't think they're particularly onerous.
Okay, let's go behind the scenes a little bit here, right? Every day when we go to practice or a game day skate, requests are put in to talk to a couple of players. And if that player is requesting, if they're available, It makes it, that's the interview that happens. So it's not like the old days where you just go up to everybody and interview everybody. It's a different kind of standard. I think a lot of that changed, not only in Vancouver, but across the league post-COVID.
Yep.
So every player is not expected to speak every single day. So this idea that there's a media circus and anybody can be kind of, you know, tracked down in the locker room, that's not the way it works. You know, a player might be talking two or three times a week,
mm-hmm.
post-game, maybe game day skate, maybe practice. So this idea that it's an absolute media circus and the media is just hunting you down, trying to find, like, I don't buy that.
Well, and I also think, I think back to some of like the big controversies for the Canucks over the last couple of seasons. And even, you know, when Jim Rutherford made the crack about Quinn Hughes potentially wanting to go to New Jersey and play with his brothers and, you know, maybe we should get Luke and Jack here. We got a lot of texts in along the lines of like, great, now Hughes is going to be asked about that every day next year. I was like, no, he's not. And you look back at like, what was the number one story around the team this season? It was the Petey Miller rift. Those guys were asked about it once.
Yep.
There was that one day in Vancouver, I think in December, when Tockett and Hughes had both spoken about it, so it was natural to go ask them about it.
And Pettersson and Miller said nothing was going on. The media was.
And that was pretty much it. And I think Miller was asked about it again in Nashville by the Nashville reporter after the Gary Mason article, but that's not the Vancouver media, right? And that's because your president has gone out there. But on a day-to-day basis, it's not being, these players are not being confronted with it. We talk about it every day, but you know what? You don't have to listen. You don't have to have the dial set to 650 in your car. You can turn us off. You don't have to listen to podcasts. You don't have to go on social media and search your name and see what people are saying.
If you're a player, you don't have to. Right?
Yeah,
I want to clarify that.
That's
right.
Everyone else must have it set.
Do not clip that in isolation and send that to our bosses. Jimmy's going to be in trouble.
That stuff's in your control. You're allowed to ignore what the media is saying. This, when they're asking you questions, yeah, that's part of your job. But that part's not that onerous.
I think the most stressful time for players is the trade deadline. And sure, you're going to get more questions around then. It can feel very heavy. I look at Brock Besser this past year, but also that did come with the Patrick Alvin comments at the mm-hmm. deadline. So, you know, how much of that is brought on by the team? How much of that is natural? I think that's a valid question. Pew Suter got some as well this year. But outside of that, you know, I don't think the media obligations are that onerous. Now, let's zoom out a little bit here,
because
part of this also strikes me as hockey. Hockey feeling a certain way about media attention, because I can guarantee you there's one club on the global level that has a lot of pressure every single year,
mm-hmm.
and guess what? They win. I'm gonna go into the soccer world. The amount of pressure that those teams face, Real Madrid has the most pressure every single year. We're talking about if you don't win a single trophy or multiple trophies, your coach is fired. You're leaving the team. Like, that is a different world, I understand. But we're not talking about hockey and Canadian hockey teams dealing with a pressure that's not seen anywhere else in the sports world. It's all over, right? Like, imagine playing for the Dallas Cowboys.
And what I find bizarre is not so much the idea that the pressure affects them, because of course it does. And I'm sure the pressure has affected different players in Real Madrid, right? And Real Madrid has a lot of other advantages in how much they can spend and all that that helps them win. But you never hear, you know, for example, in the world of soccer, no one's ever like, hey, I'm leaving Liverpool, I want to go to Southampton, because people don't care as much there. You know what I mean? No one in the NBA is like, hey, I want to go play in New Orleans, because, you know, people don't really care about that team. And yet in the NHL, it's become accepted that, like, for a lot of players, it seems their greatest desire is to be irrelevant. Like, the thing they want more than anything else is to be completely anonymous and have nobody care about the team's success. And as far as I can tell, that doesn't exist. That culture doesn't exist in any other sport. I find it bizarre. I don't know how we got here that it's so desired to be hidden away, to have no one paying attention to you as an NHL player.
It's pretty wild, though, because nobody from Chelsea, Manchester United, Arsenal will be like, Real Madrid's calling, I'm going to hang up.
Yeah.
Like, no, you'd embrace that, but I think there are some, there's no doubt there's some personal challenges, right? When you're in the media that much, you're recognized on the street. I am sensitive to the players, I think, concerns sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you are paid a certain amount of money. If you're a star in this league, that comes with the attention. It's a part of the package, unfortunately. And it's a part of the package in other sports, too.
Yeah.
And it never seems to be an issue there.
It's bizarre, the whole conversation. All right, it is time for One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. Game one of the Eastern Conference Finals tonight. It's Florida versus Carolina. I'm going with Andrei Svechnikov. 8 goals in 10 playoff games. I have a feeling goals are going to be tough to come by in this one. Two really, really good defensive teams. The Canes have always been looking for that game-breaking player in the playoffs. They're getting it right now from Andrei Svechnikov and what he's doing. Can he continue it tonight in Game 1 against Florida?
Yeah, we've always seen him as a bit of a man-child. Now it looks like he's kind of matured into that star player. I'm going to go in a different direction. Same team, though. Freddie Anderson. I know the Canes system is kind to him in the sense that they're a high-pressure team, but at the same time, 937 save percentage. The Canes have an expected goals against of 23 in these playoffs. They've only allowed 14. So he's doing his job in this series against Florida. You know, they've got three lines that are clicking. Ito Luostarinen is their 5-on-5 points leader right now. So that tells you how much depth they have. Freddie Anderson's going to have to be good in game one.
Absolutely. All right. That is one to watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. Time to put on your Toyo tires. Whether you drive a car, light truck, or van, Toyo tires are designed to perform in all kinds of conditions. Visit Delaney's OK Tire in Langley and Aldergrove. Shayna Goldman from The Athletic joins us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd here with special guest co-host Randeep Janda. This hour of Canucks Talk brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Now we now go to the hotline powered by Power West Industries, where we are joined from The Athletic by Shayna Goldman. Shayna, thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So conference finals get going tonight. The final four is set. And one of the things I always find interesting about this time of year is looking at the four teams and thinking two questions. First, what lessons will the rest of the NHL take from these four teams being the final four standing? So what lessons will they take, and maybe what lessons should they take from these four teams being left? What do you think the answers to those two questions are going to be this year?
Wow, you're making my life easy because this is one of my next stories.
There you go.
I think one of the lessons that is going to be taken from it is that you need to play like a hard physical game. I think everyone's going to look at the Panthers and say that's what it is, right? I feel like that was kind of taken away from it last year. And I get that to an extent because, sure, a playoff environment is a hard-nosed game, but I think the lesson that should be then taken is, like, you need an aggressive forecheck. Like, you need to battle. You need to give your opponents no space at all. Like, you look at how the Canes play. The Caps weren't as physical as I think they could have or should have been, but they weren't able to be, right? Because the Canes just suffocate them in every chance that they got. So that, I think, would be my Eastern Conference one. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. The West, it should be that you need a deep lineup. That to me is like ringing through my head. Yes, you need star power at the top of your lineup, and you're going to have that Rantanen and McDavid and Draisaitl in this series. But I think what has made both teams so successful is that it's not just them chipping in, right? For the Oilers, they're getting contributions from everybody. It's shocking, right? We're so used to it. You look in the regular season, you have McDavid and Draisaitl with 100-plus point seasons. The next best forward is at, what, 48 points? Like, that's a massive difference. So while, yes, McDavid and Draisaitl are still almost double most of the forwards, or more than double a lot of them, I don't think the gap is as severe right now because you're getting contributions from Henrique and Connor Brown, and Eugene Hopkins and Hyman look a lot better. And I think that's giving them this at least three-line approach that they can trust. And we already know the Stars have that, right? Wyatt Johnston isn't a first-line player because they're going with the all-thin line. You have guys like, you know, Marchment and Duchesne that are chipping in as well. So that's going to be my takeaway for those two teams.
going back to the East for one real quick second here, that gap in, you know, the style of play where the Leafs were resetting, they're slowing down the game in the neutral zone, and Florida, just the way they're able to support the puck, and yes, they employ the dump and chase, but it's with all speed. Was that the biggest gap between the two teams? Because they both have stars. If you look at the 5-on-5 numbers of Barkov versus Matthews, the chances were, you know, were kind of similar, but stylistically, was it just a huge mismatch for the Leafs in the way that the Panthers played?
I think that was a big part of it, for sure. Listen, I was not a big fan of the way the Leafs played all year. I think that they were such an exciting team. They were so fun. We all joke about it, like, how could you not have the passion about that? And then this year, like, it's night and day different. And I feel like they went too hard into that, like, older, traditional, slow playoff game. And sure, if it's 2012 and 2014, like, let's talk about it. You even want to go back to the Blues championship run since it's Craig Berube. Go off. But that isn't what's worked in recent years, right? The Avs won because they had speed and skill. They had every opponent on their heels. The Golden Knights had a lot of speed and counterattacks that kept it interesting. The Leafs, I think, slowed it down way too much because the Panthers were just skating circles around them. I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is forward strength and depth, because we're going to put a ton of pressure on Marner, Nylander, and Tavares and Matthews, and rightfully so, right? Like, pressure is a privilege, and those guys have it. But when you know that pressure sometimes can be an issue, it makes having a supporting cast all the more important. The other part of it is, when those top players might get neutralized in certain matchups, which you could say Matthews and Barkov did to each other, right? When the series was in Toronto, the Leafs went with that power versus power matchup, and it was Barkov against Matthews, and it helped keep Barkov off the board. But it opened the door to a third line, like that Marchand line, scoring a ton. When Marchand was matched up to Matthews at home in Florida, which is how they changed the matchup, the Panthers, they weren't scoring nearly as much, but they kept the top guys off the board. When Toronto was focused on that power versus power matchup, it left all this room for the third line to do all this damage, and that burned them in game one and game two, but they still won, and it burned them again in game seven. So I think those are the two most noticeable differences. They played it too slow, absolutely right, but they didn't have answers when the top guys didn't perform or were tied up in other minutes.
Well, and I think the other thing with the Leafs that stands out to me, and you make the comparison to Berube's 2019 Blues team, you know, the other thing that team had was prime Alex Pietrangelo, you know, an undisputed, clear-cut number one defenseman in the NHL level at a very, very high level. And the Leafs just don't have that, right? We've heard a lot about Morgan Rielly's struggles, and you look going forward, like, Rielly's 31, Tanev's 35, OEL's 33, Jake McCabe's 31. It's difficult to see how that blue line's going to get better. We can talk all we want about the core four, and I think that's an important conversation and what they do with them, but I just don't think that blue line was ever set up this year to really go on a deep playoff run.
Yeah, or even if they go on a deep playoff run this year, you go, okay, now you're going to face a whole nother problem next year, right? And yeah. I think some teams manage that better, right? The Panthers last year had a different blue line than what they have this year for the most part. The supporting cast, they interchanged a ton. They found different reclamation projects, and when it didn't work, they found other ones. And then you even look to the Hurricanes. The Hurricanes were okay parting with their entire second line, so they didn't have to fork over too much cap to guys in their 30s. So you essentially let Chatfield and Orlov jump up in the lineup and then have a new third pair. Like, there's a willingness to make those changes when it's necessary. So I really wonder how the Leafs handle that, right? Because, I mean, the Tanev contract when it was signed, I think we all looked at it and was like, okay, he's great at what he does, but that's way too long of a deal. I think the McCabe contract is fine, but you need it that you have these either interchangeable pieces around the guys that they're going to deem the core guys on that blue line. Like, for Carolina, it's Slavin, obviously, and like the Panthers, it's Forsling, and it was Ekblad at least for a bit, and we'll see what happens this summer. But they have guys that they're like, okay, these are our staples, and everybody else, if they're here, great. If not, we'll find a better option or the same option. I just don't know if the Leafs are going to be able to do that, but I put that on management. Like, it doesn't surprise me to the fullest extent that someone like Caleb Ng isn't the most inventive general manager when you look at his Calgary era, but now it's going to look pretty glaring.
Yeah, and I think the number one change that people expect in Toronto now is for Mitch Marner to leave, obviously, as a pending unrestricted free agent here. And we'll see. It does seem pretty likely that he'll go elsewhere. I also know, you know, that's a lot of regular season production to try to replace if you're the Leafs with limited options on the unrestricted free agent market. But from the other perspective, from Marner's perspective, which destinations do you see around the league that you think would really make sense and would be able to pull it off to go get Mitch Marner this year?
It's a good question because, you know, you have to wonder where does he want to set up, you know, him and his family. That's going to be a big part of the conversation. Because in a perfect world, you could say, well, he'd want to go to another contender. Who wouldn't? And not everyone has the cap flexibility, right? Like, everybody could want to go to a team like Colorado or Tampa or Florida. Like, all right, how are we going to afford that? But I think if there's other up-and-coming teams that would be really interesting for him. I personally am rooting for it to be someone in the East, preferably in the Atlantic, because I think a little bit of spite can go a long way, and we're seeing that with Mikko Rantanen right now. Like, if I'm Mitch Marner and I'm leading the Leafs, I look at it and go, I want them to have to see me numerous times a year, and I want to be the one eliminating them in the postseason, just like Rantanen, like that works. So I feel like a team like Detroit could be really interesting for him because they have a solid team. I think management did them a disservice over the last year, but signing someone like Marner could be really interesting because you would get to be the guy in Detroit. But you also have really good guys around you like Larkin, like Raymond, that it's not you and you against the world. So I think that could make a lot of sense. I hope it's one of those teams that they're on the brink of something special and he gets to be the one leading them to it.
All right, I had this thought. I don't know if Mitch Marner would be interested in this market, but when you talk about a team or a franchise that needs star power and needs maybe that level of talent, doesn't the Seattle Kraken make sense? They feel like they're a market and they're a team that needs that star treatment right now.
Yeah, and they could definitely use someone with his ability on the wing. I mean, him and Matty Beniers would be an unbelievable two-way combination because I think Matty Beniers is showing these signs that he has that Selke caliber in him, just the way that he retrieves pucks and exits his own zone with control. Like, it looks like one of those all-star centers who are going to be able to do a little bit of everything. Imagine the two of them together, like, that would be absolutely sick. It'll be interesting to see what approach they take this year, though, right? Because we knew them in the beginnings to be more patient, and then they had the green light to spend and maybe didn't do it in the perfect way last year. So we'll see what they learn from that. Like, if you're going to open up, you know, the checkbook, it better be for someone who has that star ability. And he's someone who does, and I feel like they have a pretty good foundation that could use that at the top of their lineup for sure.
Talking to Shannon Goldman of The Athletic here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. So getting back to the conference finalists, the teams that are still playing here. And, you know, one thing that's struck me, and I'm not the first person to bring this up, is just, you know, all four of these teams, perennial conference finalists at this point, right? Have made multiple trips in recent years to this stage. Obviously, Florida, back-to-back Stanley Cup appearances with a win last year. These are all, again, perennially successful teams. And I guess, on the one hand, that's not surprising, right? Good teams stay good. But does it feel like it's getting harder in the NHL to go on kind of that one-off miracle run where you aren't a perennially successful team, but you manage to go deep and maybe even challenge for the cup?
Yeah, definitely, because it's hard to break through, right? Like, it's hard to make the playoffs in the first place, and then it's hard to do damage in the playoffs. And if you're not, like, there are lessons to learn from being there before. You should have that experience. It helps. I think sometimes that gets, you know, overblown, and you see contracts handed out to guys like Andre Palat, and it's like, okay, well, that's a 16-game player. It helps have that, but you can't have a full roster of it. You have to have that balance. But, I mean, every team is looking for that long window, right? And I think we're seeing teams be a little bit more willing than they were maybe a couple years ago to say, okay, we're not good enough. We're not going to spend as much at the deadline than maybe they would have a couple years ago, right? And I think it's different. Teams want the playoff revenue and they want to get there, but how many swings are you taking just to fail, right? It doesn't happen often that those lower seeds make it into the playoffs. And I think that gets thought about a lot, but then this year you see, and it's like, okay, these aren't first place teams doing it, but they were teams that they knew if they get to the playoffs, like, they'll cook once they get there. I think that's harder to have if you're a team just trying to break through, right? You can't play your regular season the way the Oilers did and go, it's fine, get to the playoffs and we'll turn it on then. They know they can do that. They've been there before. So I think that's why we're seeing some of these contenders. But I also think we're seeing teams, you know, try to think of the long term a little bit more, right? We're seeing teams go for moves. Look at the Hurricanes. They didn't just keep Mikko Rantanen for this playoff run. They were like, no, we're actually going to take a different direction completely and do something that's going to position us for years to come. So that could be a big reason why. And the same goes for the Stars, like finding that balance between the old guys and the young guys, and look what happens.
Yeah, Jim Neal has done a fantastic job of making his team competitive and maybe a cup winner this year, and then at the same time bringing in players like Stankoven and Johnston and Maverick Bork, and the list goes on. But on that Dallas Stars team, in the last round, they got it done in six games. But the beginning of that series, Mikko Rantanen was going off. He had some help from Mikael Granlund. But the offense kind of dried up from the other players on that roster. In the conference final against Edmonton, you talked about Edmonton's depth in the last round. We know what they have in the star power, but if certain players on that roster in Dallas can't maybe step up and up their offense compared to, like, I'm looking at a player like Jason Robertson and Matt Duchene, are they going to have a chance in this series without having that depth? Because Edmonton's got, the superpowers that are McDavid and Draisaitl.
I think the big thing is that the Oilers pour offense on their opponents, right? Like, they don't play it safe. They don't sit back. And I think, especially after those first couple games against the Kings, we just see them amp it up and keep the pressure up as high as possible. So that's what the Stars are going to have to contend with, and that means contributions from everyone, right? Like, you can hope that Rantanen can carry them through and score more hat tricks and do all that, but, like, that's just not sustainable. I think something that's going to be interesting is how the defense factors into it. Like, they're starting out, it looks like, with Haskin and Harley together. And I get that. That's a super pair, right? They're incredible on both ends of the ice. Why wouldn't you want that? But I do wonder if they get split up at all to spread the wealth a little bit. Because if you have two puck movers on different pairs, then more forwards are going to get time with those defensemen. So instead of just the top line a little bit, the second line getting Harley Haskin in, I feel like your entire top nine is, guaranteed to be playing minutes with someone who can really activate on defense. And that's going to be important because the Oilers have that now, the way that Wallman and Klingberg are playing on that third line, on that third pair. Plus, you have, obviously, Bouchard on the top pair. So that's what I'm watching for in this series, because I wonder if that's what gets this forward group going a little bit more than they were later in that series against the Jets.
Well, especially with the drop-off from Heiskanen and Harley to the rest of the Stars' defense corps, right? It would be one thing if they had more depth back there, but it feels like inevitable that they're going to have to split those guys up. And I wonder if it'll be kind of, they play a lot of shifts together, but then also a lot of shifts apart and just play massive minutes because that's what they have to do because of their lack of options elsewhere on the blue line.
Yeah, like, could that be that third line third period adjustment where you say, okay, we're down a goal, now we're going to put them together and let them cook? And it's something the Oilers know how to do, right? Like, this is where the coaching, that chess match is going to be so interesting, because Chris Knobloch is such a good coach. I think he's made great adjustments all series. I think he's really, I don't care about the regular season. I'm not holding that against him. You look at the last two postseasons and I'm like, this is a guy that knows how to get his teams going. And we saw that early in the playoffs, right? It's the, in case of emergency, throw McDavid and Draisaitl together and see what happens. So if Harley and Haskinen get thrown together, do the Oilers counter with that? Like, I'm really going to be interested to see how they try to handle that, or if they feel that they're fine in the way that they're playing, like, it doesn't matter, that you don't need to just start, panicking and making changes to counter that. But I wonder how Pete DeBoer handles his lineup, because I don't think he does that as much in the playoffs as Knobloch does, but I think in this series you might have to.
Shayna, always really appreciate the time. Great stuff. Thanks for doing this. Hopefully we can chat again soon.
Thanks for having me.
That is Shayna Goldman from The Athletic here joining us on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. And she makes a good point just about that chess match at this stage of the playoffs. And I think about all of these teams, they have that element where they have those, the kind of aces in the hole that they can move around and either use to neutralize the other team's top players or really put pressure on the other team. And I mean, we were talking about Heiskanen and Harley there and how they can do that on the back end, but think about how much Pete DeBoer has played Mikko Rantanen. He's found times, okay, I'm going to double shift him. I'm going to get him those shifts with the fourth line to really put the pressure on the other team. On the other side of the bracket, when Florida's at home and they can put Barkov and Forsling out together, that's basically an automatic shutdown of the other team's top players.
It goes back to last year. Remember at home against Edmonton, it was
they were dominant.
Night and day, right?
Absolutely.
Edmonton, it was a different story. In Florida, it was Barkov and basically locking it down.
Jacob Slavin for Carolina, sure. Very similar thing, right? When they have the ability to put him out against certain guys, they're going to feel very, very confident in their ability to win that matchup. And so I wonder for both of these series, how much is it going to come down to kind of who can win that chess match? Who can get their star players out in the most favorable situations? Can you get McDavid away from Heiskanen, away from Harley, right? On the other side, can you get Barkov away from Jacob Slavin when you're in Carolina?
For sure, and that's going to be something. I think there's a couple of things to watch here for both of these matchups, but you know, the Canes have been clicking. They won 8 of the 10 games in the playoffs. A lot of that has been coming, you know, I wouldn't say easy, but they've had a pretty decent...
They have been the least tested team so far, I think it's fair to say.
And that's good because you're rested, but at the same time, you haven't been punched in the mouth yet.
Yeah.
Right?
See, I don't worry about that with Carolina. Like, they haven't broken through to the Stanley Cup final, but they've played a lot of playoff games. You look at up and down that roster, they've played a lot of playoff games.
This opponent swept them last time in the Conference Final, right? I talked to Seth Jarvis yesterday. That's an interview you can watch on Hockey Night Canada, Punjabi, on our YouTube channel. And it's still... You can tell that it still kind of bothers them that they were an easy out for the Panthers team a couple of years ago. And until you get punched in the mouth, though, you don't know how you're going to react against this team where it feels like Florida is just getting better and better as every round goes on. So it's that whole idea of flipping the switch. And that's where I start looking. We got some beeps going on here. Is there a microwave in the studio? What's going on here?
This is like an emergency broadcast. Like, what's going on?
I don't know. Anyways,
where is that even coming from?
You have 10 seconds to disarm the bomb, Mr. Bond.
I mentioned the dark arts of the Florida Panthers, and all of a sudden...
I have no idea where this is coming from.
What is that?
Anyways, luckily we got a break coming here pretty soon, so if we're back on the air, we'll let you know what it is.
And there it goes. All right. Well, I assume we're all safe and everything's good to go here. That was quite something. As you said, we do have a break coming up here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, so keep your thoughts coming in. Lots of people had thoughts, of course, about the conversation we were having about the pressure in a Canadian market. What role that plays in Canadian teams' lack of success. So we can read some of those at some point later on in the show as well. Some people texting in asking about can we turn this Leafs misery into the Canucks advantage? Are there players they can pick off, players they can try to scrounge from the Leafs if they really break up that team? That's a conversation we can have as well. Also wanted to tell you about Jampro. From showrooms to stockrooms and everything in between, Jampro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit jampro.ca. We'll take a break. Landon Ferraro joins us next to talk about the conference finals. And also I want to get into Adam Foote being hired as the new Canucks head coach and what that transition might look like as well. So that's next here on Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Randeep Janda here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, footwear and orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This hour of Canucks Talk today brought to you by your lower mainland Boston Pizza. A fast lunch doesn't have to mean fast food. Satisfy your midday cravings by choosing a main, side, and drink for only $15, served in 20 minutes or less. And Landon Ferraro is going to join us here momentarily, get his thoughts on the conference final matchup, especially out west here with the Oilers taking on the Dallas Stars again in the conference finals. And also want to get his thoughts on Adam Foote being promoted to the head coach of the Vancouver Canucks, what that might mean for the team, and also the process of filling out his staff as well, which is going to be interesting. And I wouldn't be surprised if maybe we get some news on that front this week about, you know, he said, I want an offense guy, I want a defense guy. What's that going to look like ultimately?
Yeah, veteran versus, you know, we've seen in certain sports, you look at what they've been able to do with the Jacksonville Jaguars. I know it's a different sport, but there's a very young coaching staff mm-hmm. for Liam Cohen. Hockey has been kind of slow on that. They usually have a mix of veterans, but Adam Foote mentioned, hey, of course you'd like to have some experience, but it's going to be more about the fit.
The right guy.
So it doesn't have to be a veteran.
And, of course, guests on Sportsnet 650 call in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on, and we now go to the hotline powered by Power West Industries, where we're joined by Landon Ferraro, former NHL player, now an analyst here on 650. Landon, what's going on, man?
Oh, not too much. What's up with you guys?
Just enjoying another Leafs flameout of the playoffs in Game 7, to be perfectly honest. I'm not above it. I'm not better than that. I did enjoy watching that Game 7 collapse. I gotta be honest.
At least you can admit it. It is for everyone outside of Toronto, and I feel like pretty much a lot of Toronto, it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes, it really is. It's just always the same, and it's always hilarious.
Guys, it's also weird, though, because it feels like there's a fan base that actively hates their own players. Like, you don't normally see that very often, but I felt like after that game, it was everybody was yelling at the core four.
Well, I mean, I think the tough part there is the fact that they've been together for so long, and they've, you know, at this time of year, essentially, after the first or second round, it's always, we're going to stick with it. We'll try and add some pieces, but we trust our guys. And they just have not been able to push past.
Yeah. And it feels like this is at least the third year in a row now where they've lost in the playoffs. And the reaction has been like, well, that's it for the core four. There's going to be big changes. And then there really hasn't been. I know there was the coaching change coming into this season, but it does feel like it's at that point now. And, you know, just even from the players in the room, as you said, like the message is always, hey, we believe in ourselves. We're going to keep at it. Do you get to a point where even the guys, the key players in that room, look at it and say, you know what, something's got to give here. Something needs to change.
I think so. And I don't think you could sit in there and, you know, you can have some of the best players in the game that are able to put up points, especially during the regular season. But after this many years, like, it doesn't matter how good of a friend someone is, they're still going to be your friend, but like, you only have so many years to win and you can only play for so long. Like, you need to start making, not that the players are making the decisions, but starting to be okay with the fact that, you know what, we do need to shake it up. We need to bring in different types of players, different, you know, that bring different assets to the team, because clearly what we have right now doesn't get the job done. And there's nothing worse, on top of just losing in general, but there's nothing worse than putting in a year full of effort and, you know, like, that's mentally, physically, you're giving up time from your family and you're looking around like, we have the same result, and that's just not, it's not good enough.
Well, what was shocking was that Austin Matthews, after that game seven loss, and he says, we had too many passengers and they wanted it more. Like, as a former player in that league, you know, when you hear that captain say that about a team that should be the hungriest of the bunch, right, based on this could have been their last stand as a group together, like, when you hear that, what does that tell you about maybe the vibes in that room? And is just nervous energy, is that pressure? Because there's been a lot of conversation about, you know, playing in Toronto, playing in Canada can come with pressure.
I mean, you can't discount that. And I know, like, people, fans, like, they don't want to hear about pressure because while you're getting paid a ton, you just got to perform. But, you know, at the same time, if you're playing a team that's from Florida and they essentially have zero pressure and they're able to just go play, whether you think it's there or not, like, it does affect you and you need to be able to kind of push past that. But I think the comments are, you know, I don't want to say mind blowing, but it kind of blew my mind that's the type that's coming out there. Like, you know, I think, you know, maybe not the diehard fans, but for the people that are just watching hockey and they, you know hockey, like, you can handle the Leafs losing in game seven if it's a tight game and they threw everything at it. Just like Brad Marchand said, like, they're a really good team and there's a lot of really good teams in the league and only one team wins every year. So, like, you're just because you have a very good group doesn't guarantee you a cup, but the one non-negotiable is working. And I know, as Craig Berube is sitting there and looking at everything, like, that's the part that's going to eat at him for sure, is hearing and seeing the efforts in five and seven. know, like I quickly played for Berube when we were the St. Louis Blues farm team in Chicago. And like, if there was one thing I knew from the moment I stepped on the ice with him was effort, and like that desperation was non-negotiable. And to watch especially game seven, like that just at the biggest time of the year, there's just really no excuse for not being all in. Like there's nothing to save it for. It's such a cliche, but like, you know, guaranteed guys are yelling that out before they go out on the ice, like nothing to save it for. Let's go do it. Well, there's a mental block there somewhere. And at a certain point you need not, you know, the perimeter players, you know, the lower guys in your lineup to come in and make a difference. Like you need your big guys to make the stand. And, you know, like, yes, Matthews scores one in game six, but between all of them, it's not good enough. And when you have that much money at the top of your roster, it just reflects it even more.
Yeah, and especially not just the Game 7 performance, but when you pair it with the Game 5 one, right? So it's the final two games at home are almost identically horrible efforts. Like, it kind of reminded me actually a little bit of some of the conversations we were having about the Canucks this year and their home record. And it's just kind of, man, what is going on at home? These should be the games where it's easier to have that energy and that drive, although obviously with the Leafs, it was a much bigger situation in the second round of the playoffs and in Game 7. Do you think there's something to the, okay, well, it's at home, you're almost psyching yourself up too much because you're playing in front of the home fans?
I think that this is definitely part of the issue. I mean, and it doesn't excuse it, but at the same time, you know, you go on the road, you know, if you have a, you know, a bad first 10 minutes, but you survive it, like there's nothing coming against you. Yeah, the other team's crowd is cheering and they're happy and excited and they can try and pull momentum that way. But when you're at home, especially in the Leafs position where it's been year after year after year of this, like they don't get to a good start. Well, the boos start coming. And then like, you're just like, I can imagine those guys almost just waiting for the crowd to turn instead of trying to force them to get behind them. It's like, it's kind of the perfect storm. Like the players are almost waiting for it and the fans are waiting for the team to implode. And then they get to be right. But in being right on both sides doesn't work for anyone.
Speaking of the Canucks, last week they introduced Adam Foote as the new head coach following the departure of Rick Tocchet. Of course, Foote spent 2.5 years as an assistant to Rick Tocchet here in Vancouver. What kind of challenge will that present for Adam Foote, moving from the assistant to the head boss here behind the bench for the Canucks?
I think the biggest thing is not losing himself. What I mean by that is, of course, he's going to have to change a little bit on how he not only like interacts, but just with how he is dealing with the guys. It's easier when you're assistant to kind of buddy a little bit. You can really let them kind of sound off. You know, if you have that trust built up with a player, you know, they can say some things that they wouldn't want to say in front of the head coach just to get it off their chest, and they can listen to it, figure out what's really needed, and then move forward from there. Like, you know, I had Jeff Blashill for 3 years down in Grand Rapids, and then he took the job got the job in Detroit. And like, it was getting to training camp, like he was very different from how he interacted in the American League. And that's a guy that was, you know, much like Foote, it was his first head coaching job in the NHL. And he was trying to make sure that he had everything dialed in. Like it is really different, but you know, Foote's so established. You know, he's had the long career. He's been on coaching staffs. He's been in Vancouver for a bit now. Like he has those relationships. So it's trying to keep those while taking on the extra responsibility of being a head coach. And I think if he can manage to do that, that's going to give them, you know, a leg up real early in training camp.
Well, that head coach job, obviously, it's tough on its own, but it's made a little bit easier when you can hire the right assistants. Rick Tocchet, you know, brought in Adam Foote, which was a great move. But, you know, how important are those assistant positions? I think they're trying to bring in two by the looks of it, whether they're veterans or not. But those are going to be two very, very important hires for this team, aren't they?
Well, 100% they are. And honestly, you could almost argue that it's more important than the head job. And you know, of course, the head guy's there, he's in charge of everything, but for what I was just kind of saying about dealing with guys and assistant, like, it's so important to have, one, guys that they respect, but also that they can have a good rapport with, because when you do get into the slog of the season, and there's going to be points where, you know, every guy in there could say they, you know, a month out of the season or a month into the season, they're saying, you know, we love everything that Adam Foote's doing and how he, talks to us and interacts with us. And then they go on a 3-week stretch of not winning and things get a little more tense. Like, that's where the assistants are so important to be able, again, for the guys to be able to ask questions that they might not want to ask the head coach because of whatever reason. And that happens everywhere. Not saying that's an issue with Foote, but it's so important to have the right guys as that second line of defense in the coaching staff room, to where you can have some real conversations when, you know, sometimes there might need to be a harsher message coming from the staff. Well, it's easier sometimes for the assistant to go up and do that because, you know, they have that better rapport because they're working with them one-on-one every single day and having a little bit, more one-on-one conversations where the coach is having to deal with everyone. They can kind of focus on whoever needs that extra attention at the time.
Yeah, and that one-on-one aspect, I think, is a really important role of the assistant coach. And certainly we've heard on Adam Foote when he was the assistant, right, how much Quinn Hughes liked working with him, how much Tyler Myers did as well. I also find it fascinating, Adam Foote himself said, look, I'd like to bring in a defensive guy to run the defense because he doesn't think he's going to be able to do that, but also an offensive guy. And obviously there's been so much conversation about, their offensive system and all that. From your experience, how much influence can an assistant coach have on the style of play that a team adopts?
I don't know to say. Well, of course they have an influence on it, but I think it's more important in the sense of your head coach lays out the groundwork of your system. And of course it's their job to make sure it's working and guys are playing to their ability, but that's where the assistants are so important in the sense of you might have a guy at the beginning of the season that's struggling to figure out how to work within the system, whether it's a guy that's already here or someone they bring in. Well, that assistant, if they have that good rapport with the guys, like, he can fill people with confidence. And whether it's through, again, you have to know your guys, whether it's through kind of playful jabs or, a bit more of a serious talk, like, you can work with guys a little bit easier before and after practice because you don't have the grand scope of the head coaching responsibility. So you can help unlock guys within a system. And I'll go back, again, just personally, but playing in Minnesota's system, getting down into Iowa, and it was a completely new system of trying to get out of our defensive zone, something that I'd really never seen, and I was struggling a lot with it. And you're trying to work with the head coach, but he's got 24 other guys he's dealing with and everything else on top of it. Like, our assistant there, Brett McLean, was the guy that was able to really kind of talk me through it and not just say, like, it needs to be done this way. Like, this is the way we're doing, and that's the only way. He found a way to kind of use the right terminology. And looking back, he also probably filled me up with some pretty good fluff to make myself feel better about it as well. But before you knew it, I figured it out, and I got playing, and I started producing. So, like, I think that's where it's so important.
I wanted to ask just quickly as well about Rick Tocchet a little bit anyways, but he gave an interview here in the market on Donnie and Dolly today. And one of the things he had to say, which I thought was really interesting on Elias Pettersson, was, first of all, he gave him a pretty significant vote of confidence, said in his heart of hearts, he believes that Pettersson will have a bounce back year. But he also said that, one, Pettersson's got to rebuild his own confidence, but he also needs to rebuild the confidence that his teammates have in him. He's got to kind of regain that trust from his teammates. From your perspective, if you were in an NHL room and there's a star player who maybe hasn't been performing, what do you need to see from them to have that level of confidence, to kind of earn, for them to earn that confidence back from the other players in the dressing room? How do they go about doing that?
Well, I think the most important thing there is what you started with, and that is Pettersson needs to find his own confidence. And that's something that, I know not only I've talked about, but other people have talked a lot about this year. Like, no one can give you confidence. You have to find that within yourself, and that comes from a great summer of training, making sure that when you get to training camp, there's no question marks in your mind. because you know there's going to be question marks in the media's mind and well, really his teammates and everyone else until he can show that I'm back and I'm doing it, then you know, it's going to be tough. But for the teammates side, like it's, I was a bubble player, like, you know, fourth line down to the American League. That's what I was, and that's fine. But when I get up and I'd be around the guys in Detroit, there was no possible way that anyone was going to outwork Pavel Datsyuk or Henrik Zetterberg. Like, that's the type of commitment that the rest of the guys need to see, is that he's putting in not the same amount of work, but like he's the leader and he's the one pushing the pace in practice in the forward group. When there's a one-on-one drill, you know, you don't want to see the guy try and find the easy matchup. Be first in line, whoever's going against you. And then whether you win that battle or not, you're right back up in line and you're yelling at the next guy's going, encouraging and doing all that. Like, just make yourself the center of everything again, because if you're in the fire, there's no way that you can be half in, half out. And I think that's a really big key for his teammates to see, that things are different. As soon as he steps back into Vancouver come training camp, you know, just beforehand, like for those guys to see, like, oh, this isn't the same Pettersson. Like, this is what we used to see a couple years ago. And okay, well, now I need to make sure my game's going, because I can't fall too far behind.
And the thing is, you know, we've seen that at certain stretches in his career. It's just a matter of he strayed away from it. So you're 100% right. You know, players feed off of that. Teammates feed off of that. And that's what this team needs right now. Quinn Hughes did a lot of heavy lifting last year, but you need two or three players at the very least that can provide that type of effort at the very minimum if you want to be a contending team. Now, switching over to contending teams, the Final Four of the NHL is set. You have the Dallas Stars against the Edmonton Oilers in the Western Conference Final. And when you look at this matchup, Landon, like, you got the superpowers of McDavid and Draisaitl on one team. And sure, they've got some help this year. They've had some solid depth, but we know what that team is powered by versus a very deep Dallas team. Like, what's the tail of the tape here? What do you think will be the deciding factor between these two teams?
Well, I mean, a lot of it falls on that Oiler depth, and especially in net as well. Through the playoffs here, like, they've been playing very well, but for the vast majority of the year, it was Leon Draisaitl carrying the team all the way through. And it was hard to tell really what this team was going to be, because they had so many injuries, so many guys that weren't playing up to, you know, to their potential as well. But now you start to, you know, playoffs start, the lineup gets kind of filled back in with Kane and Frederick and these guys. And before you know it, like, they look very good again. And obviously Skinner bobbles early and Pickard comes in and does amazing. Then he gets hurt. Well, Skinner lost his first start and then posts two shutouts. So, I mean, for them, it's just about carrying through. Like, they have their confidence back. They have their group and they're confident. And not only that, but, you know, now there's talk that Ekholm could be back in, you know, in the middle part to later part of the series. Like, that would be a massive boost for them. He was such a big part of this team on the back end. Like, he's their number one defenseman. Of course, Evan Bouchard puts up his points and has been playing well, but at the same time, like, Ekholm's that steadying force. That he's mean in front of the net. He's big and he plays aggressive. But, you know, you flip over to Dallas now, like, they're a solid, like you said, they're a very deep team. You have Mikko Rantanen, obviously, that's, you know, having a great postseason and all of that. But you look through their forward group and, like, they're fast, they're big, and they're hard to move. And not only that, they're creative and offensive. So it's about, you know, really the Oilers shutting as much down as they can, but being okay. And the thing that I like is it's not like pass where, you know, the Oilers have to score a ton of goals to win a game. Well, they posted two shutouts to close out Vegas Golden Knights, right? Like, they can play that tight game now, and they're going to have to be able to play that against Dallas, who is very good up front. They have some solid defensemen, but you also have Jake Ottinger in the back end that in net that, you know, he seems to just get better and better as the playoffs go on. But not only that, it's when the games get even more important, of course, games one and two, all the games are important, but it gets into that back half of a series and he just finds a way to close the door and really not give up anything. So for both teams, it's about taking advantage of your opportunity and not trying to give up too much to force opportunity as well.
Yeah, and your point about Edmonton and their ability to defend this year, and I think especially you think back to the start of that Kings series, they're missing Ekholm, the goals against pile up, you know, Bouchard with a bunch of gaffes in his own end to lead directly to goals, and you're wondering like, oh man, are they going to be able to survive this Ekholm absence? But then obviously Bouchard has turned his game around in a big way, but also guys like Jake Walman and John Klingberg stepping up and providing kind of that next layer of puck moving ability. And all of a sudden it goes from being this area of the team where you look at it and think, I don't know how they're going to survive, to almost a point of strength, what they have on the blue line right now.
Yeah. And the interesting part there is the fact that, again, like without Ekholm there, everyone's having to play minutes to the level that they're not used to playing. You know, Bouchard's logging massive minutes. He did through last year as well, but he's now having to play in every situation essentially. But you know, like they've started again, I think they've just found their roles, they've found their ways. They're not making it too big for themselves. Like if they just, you know, a guy like Brett Kulak, like if he just holds his own, covers his minutes really well, he doesn't have to provide a ton of offense to try and make up for anyone else or anything like that. Like they're confident in their abilities individually, and it's working when you put it all together.
Landon, always appreciate the time, man. Thanks for doing this. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah, have a good one, guys.
That is Landon Ferraro joining us here on Sportsnet 650, former NHL player, now an analyst here on 650 and on Sportsnet TV, of course, as well, weighing in on the conference finals and the importance of filling out that assistant coaching staff. And as you heard him say, like sometimes almost arguably more important to have that extra layer of communicators and teachers and guys who can really work one-on-one with the players.
And we've seen that here in Vancouver over the last year with Adam Foote, mm-hmm. right? Like being at practice, you see the one-on-one instruction he provides, the one-on-one work that he was giving to a lot of those young defensemen late in the season with Elias Pettersson, Victor Mancini, go up and down the list. You know, I remember drills that you could see that there were moments that maybe even players like Marcus Pettersson, who's been a grizzled vet in this league, were learning something new. Those assistants are so important in the situation, and that's the stuff we see behind the scenes in the video room. It's another layer altogether in identifying, having maybe sometimes those honest conversations that the media doesn't see. So, you know, Adam Foote mentioned last week that they're going to have a list. They're going to reach out to candidates at some point, but those are massive, massive, you know, roles for this mm-hmm. organization, because you don't want to be a head coach that's micromanaging, right? You
no.
don't want your assistants to have that power to teach, to lead, and you want to have to be looking at that kind of the situation in a bird's eye view.
It does feel like we're almost getting closer to the NFL model, where the head coach is like, you know, they talk about the CEO head coach, right? And he's kind of the culture setter, the big picture guy.
It's about buy-in.
And then you have the rest of the staff who's there to really install things and get the message through to the players. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We can talk a little bit more about the conference finalists. I want to build on something Shana mentioned as well about, you know, the fact that these teams are perennial conference finalists, and it's harder to break through to that tier now in the NHL. What does that mean for the Canucks? Send your text in as well. Again, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final segment of the show next here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Randeep Janda joining me today and for the next couple of days here as well. Drance will be back on Friday, I believe. We're broadcasting live from the Kintech Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at Dunbar.com. LumberJackLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by your Lower Mainland Boston Pizza. A fast lunch doesn't have to mean fast food. Satisfy your midday cravings by choosing a main side and drink for only $15, served in 20 minutes or less. Conference finals get going. Game one in the East tonight. It's Florida versus Carolina. As you said, a rematch from a couple of years ago. Both of these are rematches of recent conference finals, and that is one of the themes of these final four teams. And, you know, before we get to the nitty-gritty breakdown or making our picks here for these series, I asked that question to Shayna when we had her on, Shayna Goldman from The Athletic, earlier in the show. Like, does it say anything? I mean, on the one hand, you can kind of look at it and like, yeah, good teams are good. Is that really a revelation? They get back here and over again. But I do think it's striking when you look at it and actually dig in just how frequently these teams have been to this stage. Like Dallas, their fourth conference finals of the last 6 years, right? Edmonton, 3 of 4 years. Carolina, second time in 3 years, 3rd and 7, going back a little bit before that. Obviously, Florida, it's their third straight year going to the conference finals. 2 of them, they've gone to the Cup and, of course, winning last year. And it feels like we've really seen this is now the hardest jump to make. When you're trying to build your team and climb the hierarchy in the NHL, it's one thing to go from non-playoff team to perennial playoff team. It's another thing to go from perennial playoff team to perennial contender. And that's what all of these teams have been able to do, and able to make it so almost every playoffs, when it starts, you expect these teams to at least win one series, if not multiple, and end up playing as one of the final four teams. And of course, as we do always, right, you try to turn that and, okay, what does that mean for the Canucks? And again, I don't know if there's that deep a lesson, because just like, well, just be a really good team.
Yeah.
But I do think, and again, what Shayna mentioned was the idea of something you have to recognize is sometimes you need to keep your powder dry. Okay, so you're not going to maximize your chances in 1 year because you're trying to open up a 5-year window. And I think thinking about it that way, we're looking at what these teams have done and carving out this very clear window of at least 5 years where they're going to be one of the best teams in the league, and then you hope they find that breakthrough eventually, rather than the one-off all-in years. And I realize I'm saying that where we're all expecting the Canucks to, you know, go all in this year. I think it's a little understandable, because if you're going to sit here and break down how do the Canucks open up a 5-year window, well, the number one thing is to get Quinn Hughes to sign an extension. You know what I mean? You have to do that, or else there's not going to be any window to think of. But just that idea, and this is something fans have been texting in for a long time about, of can just be a little bit more of a long-term thinking. I'm not talking about big rebuild or tear down or anything like that, but just thinking about, rather than maximizing our chances for this year, can we create that 5-year stretch where we think we have a perennial chance to be conference finalists? It's a little thing, but I think that mindset matters a lot for NHL teams now.
Sustaining an elite level team, or at the very least a contending team, you need that long game. And for, I think, the Vancouver Canucks, it's establishing the talent that you need right now, like the Quinn Hughes, mm-hmm. Elias Pettersson, hopefully getting back to that level. But then you need waves after that. You need sustained internal, I think, you know, players that are coming up, but also then striking at the right moment. Now look at these four teams, right? So they either have two things. They have a culture of excellence, because you start looking at Dallas and what Jim Neal's been able to do.
Mm-hmm.
He is the best executive in the NHL. He's won the Jim Gregory Award for a reason. He's able to restock those shelves. He's able to use players and bring in Mikko Rantanen for Logan Stankoven. He's able to just replenish that roster over and over and over and make the right moves. The same could be said about Carolina. And I'm not going to lie, I wasn't a fan of that roster heading into the season, but they were able to find the right fits for their team, and they're back in that spot. And Florida's, you know, I think the best example in the NHL right now, Bill Zito and what he turned Florida into. They were like kind of the Club Med of the, yep, the NHL, where a lot of great young talent, but they were not a serious hockey team. They were not a serious organization. Now they are. So sometimes it starts with your executive team setting that standard and saying it might take 5 years and there might be some pain in the short term, but we're going to get this right. Edmonton's different, though. Edmonton, I feel like that serious name.
Yeah,
seriousness,
the lesson from Edmonton is have Connor McDavid.
Get a bunch of first overall picks. And eventually, if you end up getting that player, you know, are you able to, in that case, something was wrong in the water? Connor McDavid helped settle that. I'm going to take the listeners a little bit behind the scenes here, because I feel like I'm a good teammate, but there was a limit to how much of a good teammate I can be. Jamie, did your phone just go off right
now? My phone did just go off, yes. And yes, our boss is literally sitting in the corner watching us do the show while my phone went off.
I tried not to miss a beat there, but you got like the most dad ring going on here too.
It's just a standard ringtone. Why would I change the ringtone? It's a waste of my time. Normally, I don't even have it on. It's just on vibrate, but it happened to be on.
Didn't I say
not ideal?
Didn't I say a culture of excellence? Clearly, we do not have that here.
Whatever, make your point. Ignore it. The show goes on.
I made my point.
The show goes on.
Culture of excellence or just get really good players.
Yeah, the culture of excellence or draft Connor McDavid. Those are your two options. Chef Graham texts in, Canucks need to learn to make first-round picks. Go through all the teams left. They are filled with their own picks. That's from Chef Graham. And, you know, you brought up the Dallas example. And, of course, you know, Miro Heiskanen was a very high pick, right? But you go through the hits they've had either in the back half of the first round or later. Thomas Harley, Wyatt Johnson, you know, Logan Stankoven, second round pick that they use and they end up getting Mikko Rantanen for. Ottinger, Robertson, down the list.
Even, you know, in the future, Maverick Bourque's going to be a useful player either on this team or on another team if they decide to make a move.
They have had a phenomenal track record of hitting on non-premium picks. And, you know, I look at the Canucks and I think, like, last year I had no issue whatsoever with trading the first round pick for Elias Lindholm. That was a really good team and I get it. Does it fit with the, you know, open up the 5-year window thing? No, it doesn't. But I also understand sometimes you got to take your shot. Sometimes you do have to trade that first round pick at the deadline to address a need and go try to do some damage in the playoffs. So I understood it at the time. It's more all the other examples when you go back over the last 5 years and they've moved second round picks and first round picks and all of that, that is a little harder for me to stomach. But I think that's a good point is, again, it's not about... I think sometimes we set up this dichotomy where it's either you're all in, pedal to the metal every single year, or you're Chicago and San Jose and you're tearing it down to the studs. And I think that's just a completely false binary we set up. All of these teams, they've made aggressive big moves, but they've also... Florida drafted Anton Lundell in the first round, and he's a hugely important player.
Was a second round pick, right?
They've made enough of these picks, and they've done well enough on them. They've had the patience to make these picks, hold on to the players, develop them, and integrate them into their lineup, so they have that second wave of talent. And that's really one of the big things missing for the Canucks. They never developed that second wave behind, you know, even go back to when Bo Horvat was here, and it was Horvat, Miller, Pettersson, Hughes, Besser. Pod Colson didn't really work out. Hoglander has stagnated. Yep. You know, you never had that second wave of guys coming up.
We often focus on free agency more than we should. And part of the reason I say that is generally when you're dealing in free agency, you're not getting the creme de la creme of players, right? You're getting maybe one high-end player hitting free agency. Mm-hmm. The real benefit of player acquisition, the real area that you need to focus on is trades. Look at what Dallas was able to do in picking up Mikko Rantanen. That deal doesn't happen every single year, but when you load up on internal talent, when you develop talent, it gives you options. And sure, Dallas, I like Logan Stankoven as a player, but we know Dallas is going to probably get the better of that deal, especially if they're able to win a cup with Mikko Rantanen. They got him on a long-term deal.
Well, getting him extended, right? And so it's not even just a rental.
Totally, right? So you have to give yourself options. It's you might not use every single option, but at least you've got a bunch of, you know, situations that can play out when you've developed that talent, when you have your first round picks handy and ready. But it's about, I think, self-awareness more than anything. Understanding
where you are.
Where you are, and, you know, are you in a position to be a contender for 2 to 3 to 4 years? Sometimes teams, just because they have a good run, think that that's going to give them staying power. But the good teams in the NHL, I'm going to look at all four of these teams, but especially the three American teams in this context, because they are different. It's evolve or die. And when you are one of the top teams, I think sometimes what we think about is, hey, you're just going to stay good. No, these guys are putting in work. Bill Zito and that organization is putting in work every single year to have more of a competitive edge. You have to stay ahead of it. And that's what three of those teams have done. I'm not trying to slight the Oilers. I just think you have an unfair advantage when you have two of the best players on the planet.
It's a different situation with what they have, for sure. No doubt about it. All right. You want to make some picks here?
Let's do it.
Are you ready to go on the spot? I'm ready. All right. We'll start in the East. I think I'm going to take Carolina. Okay. I know everyone's saying, oh, you know, Florida's battle tested, but I like that Carolina has kind of breezed through the playoffs so far. They're rested. We all know, you know, what is it? It's a war of attrition. We hear that every year. You have to stay healthy. You have to stay fresh. They have an advantage in that area. And I think one of the themes of the fact that these are all perennial finalists is you get to this point and then eventually you get the breakthrough, right? You're going to have that breakthrough moment at some point if you're this quality a team. And I think it just is setting up nicely for Carolina that this was the year where everyone was kind of done with them. We're like, oh, they're a joke, their play style, they won't win, they lose Rantanen because he doesn't want to be there. It's over for them. And yet they've had such an easy time of it through two rounds of the playoffs, including dispatching the Capitals in five games. I don't think it's going to be easy, but I'm going to take Carolina in seven over the Florida Panthers.
All right. Stylistically, I think I'm going to love this series because they are so pedal to the metal, both of these teams. The forechecking is going to be fantastic. The neutral zone play, they play quick, head up, north-south game. I just think Florida is now, like, they're building. Right? Like, they are getting better with every round. There was a little bit of a slow start, but that Toronto series really woke them up, and they are masters of the dark arts. Like, we've seen this with Marchand, with Sam Bennett, with Matthew Tkachuk. That's still a valid question for me when it comes to Carolina. Can they play that style of game? You know, I asked Seth Jarvis that yesterday and said, hey, we got to keep our nose clean kind of situation. We don't want to get pulled into fights with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Eastern Conference Final.
Yeah, it's also, I feel
Florida's
like,
going to bring you there.
How do you not get pulled into the muck by Sam Bennett and Matthew Tkachuk? Like, that's what they exist to do. And Brad Marchand!
It's inevitable. And I think with Carolina, I'm really curious to see how they deal with that first, like, Mike Tyson uppercut in these playoffs, right? Like, they haven't been hit yet. Is that chin like granite, or is it gonna wobble them? I still go Florida. I think they're hitting like sledgehammers right now. They play that physical game. And I'm going to go, probably, I'll say Florida in six.
All right. That's a good pick. I think it's going to be a close series. I think it's going to be a fun series, but I'm betting on Carolina for the breakthrough. Western Conference doesn't get going till tomorrow. We can talk about it more then for sure as well. You ready to make a pick?
Yeah, this one was tough because I like a lot of what Dallas does, and I've been picking against the Oilers all playoffs, which has not worked out well for me. But at some point, as the McDavid Drysdale experience continues here, and Matthias Ekholm is probably going to play a factor in this series, maybe game three, maybe game four, we'll see. I just feel like unless Dallas's depth can really step up, because they haven't really done that here. It's been Mikko Rantanen, it's been Thomas Harley, it's been Mikael Granlund. Dallas hasn't played their best hockey yet, which is a good thing and potentially a bad thing. If you run into McDavid and Drysdale, I got Edmonton in this one. I think the star power of Edmonton going, having those options of, sure, Harley and Heiskanen, you could split them up and, you know, you can try to neutralize McDavid and Draisaitl, but the way that that depth has been clicking for the Oilers, the way that that duo has been clicking for the Oilers, I'm going to go Edmonton in seven. I think it goes seven.
Yeah, I've picked against Edmonton so far in both rounds as well, and obviously been incorrect. I just think the star power, and I know it hasn't changed, right? They've had these guys in the past. It's just so overwhelming. And especially now, I think in late in games, like if they're down one with 5 minutes to go in the third, I'm basically assuming they're tying it up. Like, oh yeah, they're going to tie this game. The pressure is going to be overwhelming. Yeah. They're just going to camp out in the other team's end. Then they're going to pull the goalie and they're going to find a way to get it done. Cause it's basically a power play for them. And you have McDavid and Draisaitl. And when you have that ability, and now with the contributions they're getting from their depth and on the blue line, and as you said with Ekholm, when they can ramp it up to that level, they look unbeatable.
You know what they strike me as? They're the exact opposite of the Toronto Maple Leafs when it comes to pressure. And and I'm not trying to, you know, sucker punch Leafs fans right now, but I am. I understand that. But if you heard Leon Draisaitl's comments yesterday about dealing with pressure, him and McDavid seem so comfortable. They haven't won a cup. They have basically the weight of the world on their shoulders.
Yep.
But they are so confident in their game that they have no issues with that. To say, hey, it's pressure. We got to go there and we got to do our job.
It's probably because they like the Edmonton media so much.
Maybe, yeah. Jim Matheson especially.
They love Jim Matheson and Mark Spector and the whole gang.
Shouts to Jason Gregor and the whole bunch. But it just felt like it was the exact opposite of, like, these guys feel so comfortable, and you can see that on the ice, where Dallas, like, any other year, if there's any other team, I'm probably going with Dallas. But I just feel like with Edmonton, they just feel like they're extremely comfortable. And last year, losing hurts. We know that in this city. We've, you know, seen teams go to the Cup final, losing game seven. But they've come back, it feels like, mentally stronger from that experience.
Yeah, I got to pick Edmonton, too. I'm going to go Edmonton in six. And I don't love it, but it just feels like
I don't think any Vancouver.
The level is too high that they can get to. I would love to be wrong on this one. But I'm picking in, 06 Stanley Cup Final rematch, Carolina, Edmonton.
The only thing missing.
Gary Bettman's dream.
The only thing missing is Fernando Pisani. He was at the Can-Am Pro.
I'll get all those guys back if they go final. I don't know what their equivalent of, you know, the siren the Canucks have cranked the siren. Whatever their equivalent is, they'll get all those guys
back. Last year in the playoffs, they just had, like, Zach Kassian and Rafi Torres, like, just getting rowdy. And I think there was just liquor them up, or I don't think Zach drinks, but, like, you know, Rafi Torres and those guys, that's, you know, getting them, you know, excited for the game and just yelling, basically.
Yeah, 14 goals in 24 games for Fernando Pisani that year.
That's wild.
What a wild time. All right, we got a few minutes here left in the show to dive into the Dunbar Lumber text line. 650-650 is the number if you want to join the conversation. And this one came in a little bit earlier. If the Canucks want to contend for the Cup, do you think it would be better for them to target a younger center with high upside, like a Zegras, he says, or an experienced center with a lower ceiling but with great leadership skills and proven value in the playoffs? And I do think this question actually kind of ties into the conversation we're having about, you know, opening up that window and trying to make the jump to the legitimate tier of Stanley Cup contenders in the NHL. And I think, you know, he mentions Zegras. He doesn't mention Sam Bennett. But if you're talking about, you know, experienced center with toughness and leadership and proven value in the playoffs, he's a UFA. We can use Sam Bennett as kind of a stand-in there. I obviously understand the attraction to Sam Bennett. Like, incredible player to have on your team. We see what he does in the playoffs. He's tough as nails. He's awesome. Played for Team Canada, the Four Nations. So many reasons to want Sam Bennett on your team. It just feels like it's an answer to the wrong question for the Canucks right now. Like, the Canucks are still in that position. To me, Sam Bennett would be, if I was Brad Treliving, I'd be like, can I get Sam Bennett here? That's what we need. We don't need Mitch Marner. We need Sam Bennett on our side. Because you have the talent. You have Willie Nylander. You have Austin Matthews, right? You've got guys who can make plays and score goals at a high level, and now you need that leadership. Now you need that toughness and all of it. The Canucks need the skill. That's what they need. They need the high-end skill. Even if Elias Pettersson gets back to form, they still need that other elite forward up front to complement him. And so I can completely understand the draw to that veteran center with all the playoff intangibles and everything. It's just, but that guy on a team that doesn't have enough talent, you're not becoming a Stanley Cup contender. That's not how it works. You got to get the talent first.
Okay, before we go to the Canucks, though, that, you know, that messaging of there's so much pressure in Toronto and all that by Tkachuk and Marchand, I feel like that was like basically them trying to send a message to Sam Bennett saying, hey, we've heard that they want you here.
It sucks in Toronto. It's so much better here.
No pressure. You roll into the rink wearing flip-flops. Sam, don't consider it. Like, I feel like that was their message. But for Sam Bennett, he's an unbelievable player to have on your roster if you are a playoff team.
Yes.
Is he the regular season player that the Canucks need right now? That's the question I have. 50 points is probably what he's going to get you. They need something higher end than that.
Yes.
They need a guy that's probably floor is around 60 points.
At least.
That's got to be the floor. Like, the absolute, like, basement of this player, especially with Elias Pettersson. Like,
yeah.
Pettersson is still a 50 to 60 point player, or he's in that range, and that's more points than he had this year.
Uh-huh.
But let's just say if he's that player next year, you need somebody to at least be a 1A, 1B option at the center position.
But see, I think
I don't think Sam Bennett's that guy.
I think if Elias Pettersson is, even if Elias Pettersson has 95 points next year, you need another forward capable of being a point per game.
100% you do.
And a two-way guy at that, right? Like, look at all of these teams. They have multiple guys capable of cracking 90 points on the team. You know, you go down the list. Now, I guess maybe you would say the exception is Carolina because of their style. But still, like, Sebastian Aho is an incredible player. Svechnikov is an incredible player. You know, Seth Jarvis is a 30-goal scorer. They still have guys capable of producing really high-end offensive results. It's just they don't always get the chance to do it in that system. But every other team has at least two forwards capable of being elite point producers up front. So with it's not like, well, if Pettersson's great again, you know, then Sam Bennett makes sense as the 2C. It's like, if Pettersson's great again, you still need another elite offensive producer on the team.
So those players are not going to be available in UFA status unless your name is Mitch Marner.
Yes.
Which, based on the conversation, I don't know if Mitch wants to stay in Canada. Just a hunch.
Be like, Mitch, I swear, no one covers this team.
Vancouver's so different.
It's so different than Toronto. West Coast. It's all laid back. It's relaxed. Don't even worry about it.
Just go watch a Canadiens game. Everybody's so chill here. They never get fired up. Outside of that, then you start looking at the trademark. And, Jamie, we had this conversation a couple of weeks ago. I know it's been a conversation in the city, but how do you get Matt Barzal to Vancouver?
Yes. Right?
First of all, I don't know who's on his no-trade list, so we have to be honest about that. Second thing is, what's the incentive for teams that have skilled players to trade them? Can you make them an offer that really gets them excited? And, you know, this is an Islanders team. I'm using him as an example, but other players as well. Like, you have to make it worth the team's while if they're giving up something of substance. And that's the danger. That's the tricky part. Those players aren't available in free agency. Like, I'm sorry, you know, John Tavares is not that guy at this age. You know, Mitch Marner's probably not going to come to Vancouver, but maybe they can surprise us. Nick Ehlers is the guy.
Probably the closest, yeah.
But look at his numbers on year-to-year average. Like, he's, 60-point guy, right? Yeah.
The argument would be if you give him a bigger role, can he bump that up? But, I mean, there's a question there. There's legitimate risk on that one, even forgetting about how much you'd have to pay to get him here, which would probably be a lot. I do like, just on the Leafs and the question of, you know, what they're going to do, I've noticed a lot of Leafs fans on social media, you know, laying out their master plan for how they want to change the roster, and a lot of them are including trade Morgan Rielly to Vancouver, because, of course, local guy, and they're like, well, he has no move, but he'll waive to go to Vancouver. And it's like the classic example of, you know, the Canucks have a say in this too, right?
This is the rare.
I don't know if they're jumping up to do that one.
It is so weird to hear that, because usually it's this market saying, local guy, please come here. I think most people would be like, nah, man, stay over there.
Yeah, it's like,
we don't need that salary in Vancouver.
I don't think that's really moving the needle for the Canucks. You might have heard they got a lot of blue liners, not so much up front.
Yeah.
Not sure if Morgan Rielly is
making $7.8 million or something of that nature.
Until 2030.
Yeah, I think Patrick Elvin.
So I think that's going to be a pass.
That's a flat. And that's not even a pass. That's a hang up.
That's the equivalent of the trade Elias Pettersson and Sawyer Mineo for Jack and Luke Hughes. That's the same. Like, well, that would be great for the Canucks. Not sure the Devils are so keen on that one. All right, that's the show for today. Again, Eastern Conference Finals, Game 1 tonight, Florida, Carolina, at 5 o'clock Pacific time. Randeep will be back on the show tomorrow. We're doing the crossover. Your first crossover. You get to experience it.
I am so excited because I'm not sure what to expect.
You got to bring that Drancian edge.
I don't know.
Yell at Dollywall a little bit.
We've known each other a long time. I don't have that Durantian edge. I'll bring something, though.
All right.
It won't be that.
We'll see how it goes. Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.